Hello, my name is Sam Dunnewald, and I am the host of Dice Exploder, the Emmy-nominated podcast all about RPG design right here on the Many-Sided Network. And after years of interviews and ideation with some of the best designers in RPGs, my first print game is coming to Kickstarter. Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, a John Wick-inspired game about getting your bloody revenge. Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is a game about standing in the shadow of a skyscraper in the pouring rain, bathed in bubblegum neon and someone else's blood, staring down at the man who ruined your life all those years ago, raising the barrel of a gun and asking, "Will you pull the trigger?" Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is a one-shot capsule game box set deck builder RPG, and you can follow it right now on Kickstarter. Back Band-Aids and Bullet Holes on May 5th. Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop mechanic and fly it a little too close to the sun. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and my co-host today is Sydney Icarus. Today is the launch of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes on Kickstarter, my first standalone print game. It's a melodramatic action game of bloody revenge. It's one-shot capsule game box set deck builder RPG, and you should go back it right now. I want you to play this game. I think it's a riot. Many playtesters have told me the same. I just want to share it with you. It's the culmination of everything I feel like I've learned as a designer after 3 years on this show, interviewing all of these smart people. And if you want to see all of that and all my taste distilled into a game, if you want to look into the heart and soul of my design sensibilities, and 100 episodes of this show hasn't been enough, go and back Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. And speaking of, boy, do I have a lot to say about its design. And this month on Dice Exploder, I'm gonna fucking say it. For the next 4 episodes, I'll be covering a bunch of mechanics that influence Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, and then diving into how you can see that influence in the final game. And to kick things off today, we're diving straight into the deep end of the design pool, because I want to talk about character non-monogamy. A big thing about Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is that there's no assigned characters. As the designer, I basically dump a bunch of stock characters on the table like they're action figures, and then you get to take turns picking up whichever two you like and banging their heads against each other until one of them pops off. This is really unlike most RPGs, where traditionally each player gets one main character as their avatar within the world, and the GM steps up to play everything and everyone else. Even in GMless games like Fiasco or Belonging Outside Belonging games, the typical understanding is that everyone still gets their character, and then they somehow share responsibility for everything else. And that's not how it works in Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. Everyone can get their grubby little fingers on every character, even and especially the protagonist characters. We talked some today about why I made that choice, but the reason I was comfortable making it is a little game called Space Post from Jason Morningstar. Space Post is a slice of life game about a mailman and their sentient spaceship flying from planet to planet to deliver the mail. It's what an inspiration for Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. I was playing this game a lot during lockdown when everyone else was playing Animal Crossing, and in Space Post, every time you get to a new planet, you change up who's playing the mailman and the ship. It's not the only game that fucks around with character non-monogamy like this. There's also Band of Blades, Bluebeard's Bride, and a host of other games where you have to, as I like to say about Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, share your toys as you play. So to get into all this, I invited on the show Sydney Icarus. I met Sydney a couple years ago at a con where they got in on an early playtest of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, and I correctly figured that they'd have a lot of opinions about it. But I've known of Sydney for much longer than that, in large part because they were the second host of The Hard Move, the RPG design podcast whose format I shamelessly stole for Dice Exploder. If you want more Dice Exploder but have already consumed all the archives, go through the backlog of The Hard Move too. I really can't recommend it enough. And Sydney is also a designer themselves, particularly of the award-winning Decaying Orbit, a For the Queen hack about a dying space station. And they're still podcasting about RPGs on YouTube as half of Start a Quest. But today, it's blood, space, and non-monogamy. Let's get into it. Thanks to everyone who's already backed Band-Aids and Bullet Holes on Kickstarter, and here is Sydney Icarus with character non-monogamy in Space Post. Sydney Icarus, thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sam. I love Dice Exploder. I love what you do with this, and it's just an honor to be a part of it. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to finally have on the person whose show format I shamelessly stole when I started my own.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about this. I think I'm quoted on one of your Kickstarter pages as I no longer have to do any work because Sam is already making a better version of everything I make.
You really got the sweeter deal there, to be honest. My time will come. My time will come when someone else will steal this format and then I won't have to feel responsible to do it anymore. But what are we talking about today?
So... About 2 years ago, you and I played a game of yours that's in development, and a part of that involved a lot of like players playing each other's characters and character sharing and switching. And so there's a lot of different words that get used for this. Some people refer to it as like character non-monogamy. Some people call it like troop play. Some people call it just, you know, sharing characters or a shared role or split rolling.
Character fidelity is the thing that I think about, right? Like, because then it's like a slider, right? Like character fidelity, you can have high fidelity and that's like we're only playing one character each, and you can have low fidelity and then characters are like spinning around all over the place.
Right. I think of it as, character low fidelity, there's a larger separation between player and character, and character high fidelity, everyone is playing John Cusack.
Yeah. That's the one. I prefer Joan Cusack, but that's fine. Yeah, so we wanted to talk about, you're graciously here to help me plug my own fucking game, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, coming on Kickstarter today, I think. But we wanted to talk about character non-monogamy, whatever we're calling it here today. And we picked a different game in order to do that. We picked Space Post by Jason Morningstar, which is a 2019 game. It is published primarily, I think, on their Patreon, but then also maybe you can get it on Itch and Drive-Thru these days. And why don't you tell me a little bit about Space Post? What's the deal with Space Post?
Okay, Space Post is a classic Jason Morningstar game, which is that it's kind of all based around particular vibe and the fun at the table that comes from just kind of existing in this little LARPy space world. The players all share a bunch of different characters, including a space postal agent and their spaceship and the colonists they deliver post to and the postal workers who sort the mail and all this sort of thing. But I think the key box that I would want to draw about around Space Post that makes it special is that everything is low stakes. There's a specific rule which says if you can think of a lower stakes, more subtle, like more boring way to play, do that.
That specific mechanic has been on my list of mechanics I've wanted to cover on Dice Exploder since I started the show. And maybe next year we'll get to that one. But in the meantime, we're here to talk about one of the other principles of play. There are five principles of play in Space Post. They are kindness, non-monogamy, low stakes, travel and familiarity, and roll or choose. And I don't need to go through all of those in detail, but I think they do all really push towards what you were saying of like, this is a low stakes, kind world in which you are delivering the mail. And it's in space. Isn't that lovely? I played a lot of this game during early COVID lockdown. It felt very much like this is what I was doing while everyone else was playing Animal Crossing, you know? Like it has that kind of vibes.
Yeah. I think it's familiarity with like your Euro Truck simulators or like space Galaxy Truckers or whatever, like your dad game of a, and it's not very high, like Space Post is not very high fidelity, but like neither is that genre high fidelity in terms of like wanting to deeply simulate the cockpit experience of driving a truck. It's just about those like empty moments in between Plover and, you know, New Bez where nothing is happening.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that the game really, the fruitful void of the game that the game sort of gestures to a couple of times in its text is like, the secret sauce here is the fourth time you're coming back to the same planet to like check in on the same people again. It's like, it's a game that's trying to be about routine, I think, in a lot of ways.
That's so interesting in the context of what we're talking about today, because
let's before you like dig into that thought, I want to like do a little bit more setup to bring people along. So like, I want to read first the non-monogamy principle of play, and then I want to talk about how it like kind of plays out in practice a little bit. Principles of play, non-monogamy. Anyone can play any character. You will rotate and share the roles of postal agent and spaceship and can handle everyone else however you want. Maybe you each have a stable of colonists you prefer to play individually for consistency, or maybe you decide who plays who in the moment. Either approach is fine, but the postal agent and spaceship roles need to get passed around. Play them broadly and clearly with their shared nature in mind. And the format of how this then works is like the postal agent and the spaceship fly to a planet. You meet
my understanding is there's the when you land on a planet, and usually the spaceship stays up in orbit or whatever, and so that you have the postal agent and then everybody else plays colonists.
Right. Yeah. So you have sort of like the spaceship and the postal agent arrive at a planet. The postal agent goes out and visits a few colonists, and maybe that's one, two, or three, depending on the number of players. Maybe everyone does one. Maybe you just stick around until you're bored, kind of whatever. And then they get back on the spaceship, and then they fly to the next planet. And in that time, you do a scene between the postal agent and the spaceship, like in flight to the next planet. And then you rotate at that moment when you arrive at the new planet, who's playing the spaceship and who's playing the postal agent, like passes around the table. And that's the setup. That's the whole game. You're just doing that, and you have a route of three different planets, and then you go back home to where the postal service is located, and you just go around that loop over and over and over again with as little conflict as possible.
Yeah, and I think like if it sounds thin or it sounds like underwhelming, yes, like that is kind of the on the page. So this is written really well, and there are parts of it that really show not only like Jason's skill in game design, but also his skill in like the technical writing of communicating a vibe through text. It's good work. It's good work done well. But if you read it and think like, oh, it's just a game that's kind of asking me to do the work and giving us these little like, yeah, like that is what it's doing. And a large part of it is, as you said before, it wants to draw out that sense of low stakes and repetition, and the travel scene where nothing happens. We don't really know where the scene's going. It doesn't have a point. It doesn't have a time to end.
Yeah, when I said the word routine earlier, your eyes lit up. So I want to hear whatever you were thinking about in that moment.
So your game needs to inject some sort of interest somewhere, right? That you can have a dragon land and it's a super rare green dragon, and that's where your interest curve comes from. Or you can have, you know, characters all jump forward in time 20 years, and that's where your interest comes from. There has to be these little like breaks in routine that create the ebbs and flows of joy when you play. And what I find really interesting is Space Post has none of that. Space Post has no conflict. It has no like stakes. It has no, there's no timer. There's no feeling that like, oh, we've got to make sure we get this done at Zeal quickly, because when we get back to Molev and like, maybe we'll run out of fuel. No, that never happens. And even when you get down to like the tone of this mail is like malicious, it's in that really mundane way that things can be malicious. And so when we talk about routine, yes, all the elements of the play are the same every time, but because every time you see it from a different perspective, you see it by picking up a different character, that's where it injects that like that novelty.
Yeah, and that's not the only place for it, right? Because you're coming back to the same planets again and again, but like every planet is a little bit different because maybe someone else is the postal worker on this planet this time, right? So as you're saying, but also like the letters people are receiving are different this time. And also this planet is like a lava planet, and the next planet is like covered in flowers, and like so on and so forth. Like those, the different context also kind of rotates around to provide a little bit of novelty.
I think that's a fascinating way to approach games that handle mundane subjects, or that handle things that like we feel routine and kind of safe in, is by injecting this variety of like, well, who are you going to play this time? That's an exciting new way of doing things.
Yeah. It reminds me of the Ursula Le Guin quote about like, you don't have to do stories that are about conflict, that like stories can be about other stuff. And that, yeah, the you do still want novelty in a story, so you're not getting bored probably, but like that it is cool to find other sources of that are not conflict.
Yeah. And this is where I think my first question or challenge on the non-monogamy thing kind of comes out, is that Space Post gets away with a lot of the problems with shared characters by having no stakes, by having no conflict. Because if I helped make the spaceship and I love the spaceship and I love who the spaceship is, and then the conflict is, are pirates going to blow up our spaceship? Pulling me as the player away from the coalface and like the responsibility of looking after that character, and then the spaceship gets lost and I don't get to play the character I love anymore. That's a real problem. That's a real like emotional problem at the table. And by having the stakes be like the spaceship will always be there, just, you know, things might have changed. You might have run out of snacks in the minibar or whatever. That that level of conflict makes me safe, that when I let the spaceship go, it will come back to me in a way that I can still enjoy it and I can still play it.
Yeah, I've been thinking as we've been approaching recording this episode about, like, people really are invested in playing their little guy in role-playing games. Like, people really feel attachment to their avatar in the fictional world. Like, I think many, many, many people, even, like, people who do not believe this about themselves, like, they experience role-playing games by, I am creating a version of myself, maybe a sillier version of myself, maybe a less filtered or eviler or, like, more kind version of myself, or, like, a different gendered version of myself or something, but some variation on me into this game. And then that's going to be how I, like, pull the levers and move around and, like, interact with the play that we're all doing. And that when you try to detach people from that, they don't like it. They really, don't like it. I think, like for the reasons you're kind of talking about here of, like, what if I love my spaceship, but now I'm giving up my spaceship to someone else and they ruin it, you know, or they, like,
Sam, what if you play the spaceship wrong?
Yeah. What if I play the spaceship wrong? Or what if you crash the spaceship and the spaceship dies and now I never get my spaceship back, or, you know, like, any of this stuff? Like, I think those are really, really, really primal and, like, understandable feelings to have about wanting to play the same character over a long period of time here. And I think that, like, Space Post does this interesting thing of, this is exactly what you were kind of saying, right? Allowing you the experience of, okay, maybe it is actually okay if I share. Maybe it is okay if I give up the control and loyalty I feel about this character to someone else, because the game is so low stakes, because the game has created a container in which I can do that.
Right. So I want to talk more about this desire to have characters and stuff like that. So when we think about, you know, the elephant in the room around role-playing discussion, which is, you know, the history of 90s, especially D&D, but 90s and early 2000s D&D, there is a very clear remit in that game that your authorial power as a player is tied to your character's mechanical power, that you get to say what happens if you roll high enough with your modifiers. And so that has led to a cool avenue where, like, the wizard tends to have more authorial power over stuff about magic because they're rolling the dice about that. But the bard has more authorial power over cultures and things. And that has been a nice sort of separation. But I think my curiosity here is, what direction do you think this goes in? Do you think that we are culturally hesitant to let go of our little guys because we all grew up being told that you're only allowed to say that a thing happens when your character is strong? Or have rules gravitated toward assigning player to character rigidly with high fidelity because people like that more?
I think it's both, and, like, very different for different individual players. Like, I think there are some people where, like, their taste is, I want to be the dungeon master, you know, like, I want to do, like, everything. Like, I don't give a fuck about staying loyal to one character. Like, I think, and I think that changes over time too. Like, I clearly am, like, designing a game where I'm like, no, all these people are going to, like, violently kill each other and have, like, huge emotional feelings about it. And no one's going to be locked into one character. Like, that's where I am right now, you know? But, like, is that where I was 20 years ago? Probably not. 20 years ago, like, I wanted to be pulling the levers because, like, I was 15 and I was like, yeah, this is what I want to just, like, go in and, like, muck around as a 15-year-old in this game. Like, when I was in the third grade and playing for the first time, the first thing that we did was go to the bathroom and check for toilet monsters in the inn, right? And, like, that's the thing that you know how to do, right? Like, I don't know how to, I don't have the skill, I don't have the desire even at that age to be like, no, I want to step into the writerly stance. Like, I want to go think about all of that. Like, the way I was engaging with the game was, like, as a video game. I just played Myst, right? I just was going around clicking on everything. And so I think that this is, like, such a playstyle dependent thing. But I think that the people who do feel like, I want to lovingly craft a backstory for my character, like, I want to, like, the fantasy, the fun for me is to be a particular aspirational version of myself in, like, whatever context that means within the game that we're playing. Those people feel that a lot stronger than I feel, well, but it's fun to share my toys, you know? Like, I think that maybe that's where some of the pressure is coming from.
It's there's so much cool stuff in there. First off, if anyone had told me that in third grade they wanted to step into the writerly stance, you would be my first guess.
Yeah.
You'd be my first and only guess. So, you know, affectionate. There's a interesting question here about like identity, and I think it's so fascinating that we are talking, that I'm talking to you who have just kind of discovered this love of LARP, and I've seen your like LARP design, I've played your LARP design, and talking about Jason's game, and Jason is obviously very deep in the LARP community as well, and like LARP is built on that idea of bleed, of character identity, of the player kind of vanishing in space. And I find it fascinating that you're also the advocates for this other version.
Mm-hmm. I think you can LARP without that sense of bleed, right? Like a lot of people play LARP for immersion, right? Like that is a huge conversation. That's like the system matters of LARP, right? Like, what is immersion and is it good, you know? But like, I think there are a lot of people who are like, oh, do not break my immersion. Like, do not talk to me out of character in the middle of the LARP. Like the fundamental like joy of the experience is, as you were just saying, like, I want to lose myself in the thing that is happening here, become someone else. But there are also a lot of people who are like, yeah, we're just like riffing. We're like doing an improv scene, right? And like, it's much more important for me to sort of like pause, put my fist on my head and go like, hey, how are you feeling right now? Or like, bro, that was a funny joke, you know, like, or whatever the thing is. Like there's, I think it is... I mean, I don't think that there's a better way to do anything. Like, I don't think any of these things are better than any of the others, right? Like, I think that they're all just, like, different tastes and, like, do different artistic experiences at the table. Like, they're bringing something different.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Okay, this is something I think worth talking about in this sphere is that we've kind of presenting here this idea that, like, there's character non-monogamy where anyone can play any character, and there's a one-to-one immersive high bleed thing. There's also this thing in the middle that I'm seeing a lot of at the moment, which is you either have sections of identity or you represent parts of shared characters, or like that very, you know, belonging outside, belonging approach of I am the people and you are the weather. And so while we share characters, we talk about them through those lenses. I guess I would call it a lens approach. And so Space Post's big thing is we create this postal worker and the spaceship together. And the postal worker and spaceship are always that unless they change through play. But like that is their defined structures. In a game like Bluebeard's Bride, we have this shared character of the bride that we're all playing, but I am seeing her through the lens of the, I don't remember them off the top of my head, like the crone or the...
The maiden, and yeah. I'm the mother or something, right? Like we're different parts of the personality.
Right. So when I take up this character, I am kind of doing it and I'm given permission to do it in my own way, to put my own spin on it. I am not beholden to what you did with the maiden or with the bride, because I am the mother. And so my relationship with her is immediately different. And I think that is a really nice mechanical structure to put on top, which like gives permission to some of the natural play outcomes of character non-monogamy or of, you know, low fidelity character play.
Yeah. Well, I've been thinking this is like the inside out approach to character non-monogamy, where like we're all one of the emotions in a character's head, you know? And like, that feels like a really interesting and specific way of doing character non-monogamy, where we're creating a character that is more complex than any individual's like two-dimensional take on that character, potentially two-dimensional take on that character. Like in some ways you can create a person who feels bigger than any of the individual players at the table. And that's like a really cool tool, I think, for like blowing up their personality, you know, like creating something larger than any individual.
There's two halves of this that I think are worth drilling into. The first is this idea of like complexity of character. I think it's true that characters can be like a little bit flat as we play them, as we get comfortable, as we settle into, to bring back to that word, settle into the routine of we go here and do this and the door opens and then the quest and we get paid and level up. As we do that, those characters can become pointed in singular directions, and there's some spice by adding someone who has a mechanical remit in the game to approach that character differently. The other thing that I want to pull out of it is that, like, from a design perspective, you and I can sit here and say, like, oh, I think Jason might have said this, or like, I think that Strix sees it this way in Bluebeard's Bride. I want to say that in text, a lot of games are being quite soft about this sharing. If you have a look at in games like Band of Blades, it will say things like, it's not essential that the same character be played by the same player each time, though that may be how you prefer to do it. And this is a phrase that gets used a lot about, like, it's not essential to share these around. You can play how you prefer to at your table. And then Bluebeard's Bride comes along and it's like, no, when you roll a 7 to 9, you hand the ring to someone else and they have that responsibility, right? They do that thing.
Got her.
Here we go!
Oh my god, he threw,
here
he
we
threw
go!
The chair. He threw the chair.
And now he's getting it back because we're gonna have to sit.
We are in Casey's home. That was Casey's actual chair.
You look out of the window and you see a Toyota Previa upside down on fire.
Oh, oh my god. Oh.
But it's not nearby any trees or anything, so it's fine.
On fire.
It's fine. It's not fine to me, GM. Jesus Christ, that's my fucking car.
Dynamite headbutt.
He screams as he headbutts this man.
Honestly, his left jaundiced eyeball pops out of his head.
Oh! And if you were to take a picture the second their two heads were touching, it might have been an intimate, tender scene between friends or lovers. But if you were to take a picture at any other second, yeah, it is just absolutely horrifying.
For some men, violence is a form of intimacy, which is so sad.
That is
maybe
so
sad.
Maybe
for this man. But anyway. Smashed in the head!
Bodhi has a pocket full of, like, one oversized precious moment angel that has a real strange face.
Oh, I thought that was your dick.
Oh! It was his dick. There's a hole in his pocket and his penis, which does resemble a precious moment angel with a strange face.
Oh, it's a strange face, but it actually looks like a pretty normal penis head.
And that's what we call facts.
He looks back and he says one last threatening phrase, pointing to the bar.
I'm gonna... And Violet shoots him in the head.
You see this guy's ear get blown off, flying off his head.
Ah! Bye-bye.
And then at this point, Scratch pops up like a mummy.
Ah, mummy!
Dynamite headbutt!
Something is rising, piecing itself together from the bodies and viscera around it. Its black wings spread, and it looks back at you with red, wet eyes.
Got her.
The question then that I want to bring to you as a designer in Bandits and Bullet Holes is like, and this is, you know, from memory of a couple of years ago when it was in development in a con, but we all create the characters together. We give them some pretty overarching adjectives. But then when play comes up, there's no remit to, like, play the character in a certain way or to give them a certain spin or anything like that. So can you talk to, like, your design process and what you're trying to achieve by breaking them up like this?
Yeah, so I didn't get here on purpose. That's the wrong way of saying it. You know, like, but I did not set out to end up with a game that was, like, fully character non-monogamous, you know? Like, I started with a game that I thought was going to be like a Firebrands hack, where you would come in, there'd be like four or five different scene types, all from the like John Wick verse, right? Like one of them would be like you're fighting a bunch of guys, and one of them is like you're staring down a person and negotiating, and one of them is like you've been shot and someone is patching you up, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And that the way that the game would be structured is there'd be the bloodhound, who's like John Wick, who has been wronged and who wants revenge. And there'd be the bastard, who's some horrible person who has caused the problem for the bloodhound and now they want revenge on. And we would sit down at a table of like four people, and you would be the bloodhound, and you would always be the bloodhound. And I would be the bastard, and I would always be the bastard. And yeah, first we would like create a bunch of characters as a group and then decide which character was which. But then, like, now I'm picking up Barf, the Bloodhound, and I'm always going to be barfed for the rest of the game. And everyone else who was at the table would basically co-GM. So you and I would be the primary players of the game, and on my turn, I would like set a scene that like Barf wants to do next, right? So like Barf goes to Spider and is like, Spider, where's the bastard who killed my dog, you know, or like whatever the thing is. And then one of the other players is playing as Spider, and then we do that scene, and now it's your turn, and you do the same thing. You go to Queenie and you're like, Queenie, Barf's coming for me, but I need you to like run interference for me or whatever, you know, and we like alternate you and I back scenes back and forth. And what I realized first, I'm going to do a whole episode on this, didn't need to be Firebrands at all. It was all, every scene was the same. It was just two people were like, someone wanted something and the other person was like, no, I don't want you to have that. And like, that's good drama. That's David Mamet shit. We'll talk about that next week. But like the other thing that I realized was like, this is actually another Jason Morningstar like quote or thing that he has said, is that like, DMing is like the fun part of the game, you know, like, and so when I figured that out, I was like, oh, everyone deserves a chance to do this. Like, this is why, one of the reasons he makes so many GM-less games, I think, is because that's the fun part. And like, if you can distribute that around so everyone gets a chance to do it, all the better. And for me, playing Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, the structure there was a little different than classic GM and players. And the fun part was playing as the Bastard or the Bloodhound, right? Being one of the main characters, being in every other scene until like eventually they faced each other down. And everyone else was very much like kind of a supporting role. And at like three players in the game, it worked really well to be like, okay, well, there's, I go and talk to Spider, and Spider is played by our friend Jen. And then you go and talk to Queenie, and Queenie is also played by our friend Jen. And now Jen is in every scene, and you and I are main characters, but like Jen is still around. And like, this is a really great trio kind of situation. But if we get up to four, if we get up to five players, that completely breaks down. And suddenly it's like you and I are just like obviously the main characters at the table, and everyone else is just kind of like watching us play the game, and that's no fun. And so I looked at that and I was like, why do I have to play Barf every time? The only reason I have to play Barf every time is because of that 90s tradition that you were talking about, right? Like, why don't, when it's my turn to frame a scene, I just look at all the characters on the table and I decide where the movie goes next, and I pick up a character and I play. And if that means you play Barf last scene and I play Barf this scene, then who cares? And like, there are problems that come with that, and we should continue to get into those problems. But I think there's a lot of greatness that came from that too. And one of those things was solving this problem of like players that were main characters at the table, and like, how do you deal with that dynamic when I want everyone to be getting to do the good part, right? But one of the other like big side effects that I found that it had was completely opposite from Space Post, where the fact that everything is really, really low stakes allows you maybe to feel a little bit better about sharing this like precious character that you have made with someone else, because you can feel confident that they will be in good condition when they are returned to you. In Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, every character was going to get fucked up. Like, everyone was going to get completely fucked up all the time. Anyone could die in any scene. Like, it was like, this is a John Wick game, right? Like, people are gonna be dying. And I found that when you got rid of character fidelity, a lot of people were more willing to accept that to happen, because it was like they had more space between them and their characters. When I'm not always playing as Barf, then when Barf dies unexpectedly, I'm much more willing to go, whoa, cool twist, you know, like, okay, cool, who else am I playing when it comes back around to me, as opposed to like, my game is ruined, my game is over, what do I do now? And so I feel like Band of Blades kind of has that same feeling, right? Like, you want people to like, you want the ability for characters to die off with alarming frequency. And part of the way you need to do that is by like giving people a lot of characters to play, and putting that distance between them and their character.
This is fantastic. And it's great. And I think it's really funny that I played Band-Aids and Bullet Holes with three people, and it was exactly that. And then we had someone else, we had a fourth at one point, and like, that was a different experience. I absolutely felt that, even with the non-monogamy put into it. Okay. So This is a thing I think we see a lot in games that kind of define themselves as troop play, and that's games like Ars Magica or Good Society or whatever, which is you each get your guy, your main character, your magi or your...
Primary character, I think, is a thing I've seen here, which is, you know, has the benefit of abbreviating to PC.
Oh, that's great. That's lovely. I do love games that find a new way to get you to the GM abbreviation. They're like, oh, no, you're not the game master. You're the
general manager in Triangle Agency. Or my favorite is the Dino Master in Escape from Dino Island.
I love Escape from Dino Island. We should find an episode to talk about that. So this idea that you have a primary guy that you can be protective of, and then you've got a bunch of little guys that are essentially designed to be foils, right? They're designed to be your John Wick mooks that run in and get shot. And so you have something you can be protective of and something you're less protective of. And then I think that is born out of that tradition of like, players need something to hang on to, and so we'll give them this. And when we make the decision to move into the wholly low fidelity, the wholly non-monogamous approach to characters, I often find that is where people split. And there are a lot of people who just say, like, because this is the thing that I want to challenge you on, is that you say to me, like, by having character non-monogamy, you are less attached to your character and you can more accept things. And that is true for some people and for some players. And there are a lot of people who, you'll see them in a Band of Blades game, will be like, yeah, so I played this sergeant and I had a really good time. And then in the next mission, they're like, well, we need a heavy instead. And so they send the heavy, and the player's like, oh, I was really enjoying playing my sergeant. I really wanted to. And like, it's not that there's not enough mechanical structures or there's not enough stuff in the game text about it. It's just that it was really fun to play. And for some people, it can be like, no, I love playing heavies because they have this cool ability that I really like using. And for some people, it can be about the character and like the emotional experience. And I just don't think it's true that this sort of low fidelity character assignment makes people less connected. I think people who are less connected find it easier to do the low fidelity character type.
Yeah. So I think Bandits and Bullet Holes is gaining that separation between player and character in a couple of other ways also. And so maybe I'm wrong and the separation is coming from these places instead. But the one place I think that it's gaining that separation is that the game is a one shot, right? And it's people don't have a huge amount of time to get bonded to these characters. You know, you sit down, you start playing, and like the way Band-Aids and Bullet Holes works is you take like 11 character cards, you toss them on the middle of the table, they got cute little art on there, and then you take like 6 of those and plug them into like a relationship map, basically called a powder keg. And then that tells you like, this guy killed that person, and then that person, her like husband is mad about it, and like that's what the revenge plot is about. And there's also like these side characters, blah 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 blah. But so we like set all that up as a group, and like the sort of core thing that the table is kind of rallying around during that process is the story, is the situation, or if not the story, right, is the like the idea of what happened to this community. Maybe community is the thing that they're kind of rallying around. But so you're getting to know like a bunch of different characters at once and getting invested in like the arc of how is all of this going to come together. I'm sort of like guiding everyone into a writer's stance to begin with. And then like someone picks up a character and like maybe I pick up Barf and I try on Barf for a scene and like, okay, cool. Like I feel solid about Barf, but like I've only played Barf for like 10 minutes and I played Barf for 5 minutes in the scene or something, you know, and we all played Barf together for like 20 minutes while we were setting this up, right? So we're all, and this is very similar to how Space Post does it, right? Of like we all collectively, collaboratively create the postman and the spaceship. And so it feels like that, right? But then, you know, the whole game is only gonna be 2 hours long. And so like, I don't have like a huge amount of time to, you know, we were talking earlier about this, like, you got to find, like, how do you play your character, you know? Like, how do you settle into the routine of who this person is? Like, that's one of the joys of Space Post over time. And, like, you just, you know, one shot in a 2-hour session, like, you don't have a ton of time to do that. And so I think, like, I'm dodging bullets that way. But the other big thing I think the game does to put that separation in there is, like, it's using pre-made characters, right? Like, Barf is a guy in the game. He's got the stench of spliffs, and he's got bloody knuckles, and he's got, like, art, and the art is always the same, and, like, that guy's, like, a whole guy. Like, you're nodding and laughing and shaking your head because you've met that fucking guy, right?
I have. Like, and, like, the thing that's really unique between them is you pick the masks for them, and, like, in my mind, Barf has the chicken mask, like, that rooster mask, and, like, that just is him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this is not super in the game anymore. There was one particular character. So the idea is every character has, like, 3 calling cards, right? And the calling cards are things like that, right? It's the stench of spliffs. It's the bloody knuckles. It's the bisexual lighting or whatever they have. And one character has a chicken or an animal mask that, like, covers their head. It's like a Hotline Miami kind of reference, right? And it's not every character that has that, but, like, that one really stuck out to you, right? Like, you really remember Lockhart, who had an animal head mask. It was like a chicken mask on the card when we were playtesting. And that, to me, makes it these characters all feel like they already exist. Even as you come in, you get to, like, make up the third calling card, right? So Barf's got his stench.
Someone had a suitcase, like a briefcase handcuffed to their hand always.
Also Lockhart. Yeah. So Lockhart, like, came with, Lockhart actually isn't in the game anymore, but Lockhart came with an animal head mask and a briefcase handcuffed to their wrist. And then you'd fill in the third one, right? So, like, maybe you'd fill in the third one as, like, a pet goldfish or something to, like, you know, kind of, like, undercut the character a little bit. Or maybe you'd go all in and it'd be, like, a raspy voice or whatever. And so you get that, like, little fingerprint that you're putting onto Lockhart. But, like, you remember Lockhart so strongly from 2 years ago off of, like, tiny details that I put on the card, like the little bits of fucking poetry that went on there. And so that makes it feel like Lockhart is this person who's already wandering around out there, you know, that, like, Lockhart is like Hamlet. They're a role in a play, and you're going to step in. You're going to bring your pet goldfish or whatever that third calling card is. You're going to bring your fingerprints to Lockhart when you step up and play them. But they are, by virtue of already existing, of having that art, of having those, like, predefined calling cards, they feel less like your property to begin with. They feel like independent entities that you are sort of borrowing from the jump. There's a metaphor that I use in the game text a lot that's like, hey, you're going to take all these character cards, you're going to dump them in the middle of the table like a pile of action figures, right? And then, like, when it's your turn, you pick up your favorite toy and you whack it against another toy for a scene, and then you put it back down. And, like, I think that is very much the feeling, where you can still feel like Lockhart or Barf or whoever is your avatar, but, like, it feels like trying on a set of clothes as opposed to, like, stepping your whole self into a new character.
Yeah, I think there's a sense of scale here of, like, if I, if I play the D&D campaign for 6 years, then I spend 6 years with this character. And me taking on Barf or Lockhart is no less playful. I'm just doing it for 20 minutes instead of for weeks or years or whatever, an hour at a time. And it's, I think that is really beautiful, because I think that to see character low fidelity is like, and so don't invest in them or don't play them or, like, maintain separation is, I think, not only foolish, but, like, really loses some of the beautiful joy of, like, taking on another character as another person as a shroud and being like, I'm gonna play this into this avatar. Which is why when I see things like you know the discussion of, in fact, let me do a, like, tell me about your character thing. Played a game of Band of Blades. We had a sniper that one of the players had played and had a great time and, like, had a big moment in play, and so there became this attachment of everyone to that character. And then specifically, like, this one person was really good at doing the French accent, and this one person was, like, really felt like they captured the essence of her, right? And so we play the entire Band of Blades thing. We get up to the second to last location, and this sniper's got 3 trauma and a whole bunch of corruption, and, like, is very much on her way out. And the discussion was, we probably need her, but she's probably going to die. Let's make sure this person plays her for the final time or whatever. And it didn't end up working out. We kind of needed a different character, and we ended up splitting up. And we wanted to really get away from this character monogamy thing of like, oh, that's that person's character. They should play them on the way out. So we intentionally stepped back. And when we got to the moment of the character finally meeting her end, the person who was playing her actually turned to that original person and was like, I don't think I can do this bit. Like, I want to pass her back to you for this. Now, I have a lot of feelings about that. Notably that, like, that tension between, like, this is your toy and I'm just borrowing it for a while and, like, you don't want to break it, I think is a tension that game text and design, and even you when you're speaking to me, wants us to let go of, like, wants us to drop, right? Wants us to give up this attachment that we have to character and, like, grow beyond it. But I think about that metaphor you use all the time, Sam, of like, when I tip my action figures into the pile with you, when I tip my Superman and my Batman into the pile with your Green Lantern and Aquaman sucked in, I still want you to respect the fact that, like, that's my, like, I don't want you to, like, pull his arms off.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, like, the way I feel about it is I made the toys as the designer, right? Like, when I dumped them on the middle of the table, it's not like we each brought two toys to the party. It's like we showed up at the party and there was a pile of 11 toys on the floor, right? And I think hearing you talk about it, there is something really appealing about the, like, one of the reasons we're playing these games is because we want to be the avatar, right? Like, we do want to go in there and, like, have ourselves in this, like, different world, right? Like, that you do want that connection. Like, that there is something really powerful about that connection. But I wonder if, like, the reason that this lack of fidelity is so appealing to me is because it gives you a chance to backtrack if you make the wrong call in your first scene of which character you wanted to pick up, you know, that, like, it gives you, like, more room to play, more room to, like, try on something else, like, even as those bonds are forming, you know, like, over the course of a game of Bandits and Bullet Holes, typically you end up with, I don't know, maybe we do 6 or 7 scenes, and, like, 3 of those are led by the Bloodhound, 3 of those are led by the Bastard, and 1 of them is led by some, like, NPC who has, like, taken on a big subplot of their own, right? And if I'm playing as the Bloodhound in all of the Bloodhound scenes, that's great, you know, like, that, and then we're getting the thing that you're talking about, then we're playing Fiasco, basically, right? Like, and that works fine. But I do think that there's something that I like in here about the, like, okay, I played Barf in the first scene, and I liked Barf's art, but it just didn't, like, I wasn't finding it. It wasn't clicking for me, you know? But then, like, I watch you play Queenie, and I'm like, oh, I get that, though. I, like, know her. Like, it turns out that, like, she's had her heart broken, and I had my heart broken recently, and, like, I get it now. Like, I see that over there. Like, I like, and then, and maybe you don't know what's going on with Queenie exactly, right? And, like, the game leaves. I like that the game leaves open the door for that kind of negotiation, right? For that, like, sorting, that, like, playing around in the early scenes to find out who are we enjoying playing, and then going and following that later on, right? Because, like, a thing that's really, really common also is, like, in the scene where I'm playing as Barf and I come to Spider and you're playing as Spider, and, like, Spider was, like, didn't matter to this story at all. It was just kind of, like, there on the board because we needed to, like, fill out the board a little bit. But now it's your turn and you're like, but I liked Spider. Okay, well, I could go back to the main plot, but, like, what if I want to, like, stick with Spider? Like, giving you the choice of, like, okay, is the right thing to do to stick with the main plot? Or, like, maybe I do want that, like, character monogamy thing. Maybe I do want to, like, see Spider in the action more and, like, get them in here. Like, giving you the opportunity to follow that without requiring you to follow that. I think that, like, it's very fun to watch that dynamic happen at the table in my playtesting.
Yeah, that's a thing that I think is really cool to talk about here, is, like, how this can drive different decisions in play. And a great example is, oh, I really want to be with this character. That's not where the plot is. I guess we're discovering some, like, side quest now. And that's a thing about, you know, that I think Band of Blades does really well in terms of, I really want to play this character. Can you send them on this mission? Well, they're stressed to hell and, you know, they don't have the special ability that we need. Yeah, but I want to play them. And so that's fun and interesting. I love that. I think Good Society also does this really well. Good Society does classic troop play, where we each have an Austonian, a Jane Austen story main character, and then a bunch of connections through the town. And all their main characters have these goals to, like, get married and marry into wealth, and or, you know, find our one true love and despite wealth and all that sort of thing. But the connections are just problems you can put in the way. The connections are just the Lockharts of this world, right? And so that beautiful experience of, like, okay, we're going to do a scene at the ball or whatever. I'm going to play this one. Who are you going to play? And you're like, I haven't had a go with the Dowager Countess yet, so I'm going to play her. And that motivation to play the character inserts them into the story in an interesting way. And I think that that's something that's, like, worth capturing here, is that for people who are designing in this space, if you're going to give people a choice of what character to play, that decision needs to be meaningful in different ways every time they make it. I think the best way I can describe it is by giving the, like, counterfactual, which is, if we played D&D 5th edition, except that every time we had a long rest, we could switch characters, that is not a fundamentally better game. Like, that does not become a better game just because there's character switching.
Yeah, I do wonder, you know, if Bandits and Bullet Holes was a game that you played for six sessions and I didn't change the rules at all, I bet people would sort into, yeah, I always play Barf, I always play this person. But I bet I would also still like the lack of character fidelity because of that, like, initial, like, sorting, like, experience, you know, like, you play for 2 hours and sort of, like, feeling out who likes who or what's going on, right? But I do think that, especially over long form campaigns, there's something comfortable about settling in for who your guys are, you know, like, who are your people.
Yeah, I think a lot around games like Ars Magica, which does the same, that same troop approach, which is designed to be this giant game where your magi is building towards something. And, like, yeah, the idea of, okay, I'm gonna do all this stuff for this character and then next week it someone else might be controlling them, just doesn't work mechanically. And I think that even when I look at Band of Blades, which, you know, I think is a fantastic game and I've played it a bunch, it is a game that could use some more support for players playing different characters. They often do it through the permissive sense too, of, like, just, you know, grab a blank rookie and just, you know, make a character that you're interested in. And that's fair, but I would like to see more, like, here's how you can bring a lens to this. Here's how the game will help you to do this right. Because one thing we haven't spoken about, Sam, and knowing the kind of people that you play with, I don't think it's a problem that you come up against, but what if I'm the worst player at my table? What if I'm bad at role-playing games? What if we're playing Space Post and everyone else is doing really good Euro Truck Simulator in space things with, like, you know, surprising mail that has news and gossip and whatever, and I'm just like, I don't know, I guess I'm a spaceship. Beep, beep, boop. Like, I don't have... What if every time I play a character, everyone at the table is reminded that someone else played them better than I do?
I mean, is that not a problem even if you have your own character? I don't know. Like, I feel like I've playtested this game a bunch at my every other week meetup at the local game store where people come in and play story game one shots, right? And that scene has a lot of people who are very talented story gamers. And it also has some people who are coming in and playing role-playing games for the first time and who are often enthusiastic, but, as you say, like, not particularly skilled and, like, uncomfortable. They're like, what am I supposed to be? I don't understand, you know? And I think that my experience playing with those people is, like, kind of regardless of the game, yeah, you either, like, get on board with, like, helping bring that person along or you don't. I don't know. Like, that feels like a social problem to me, you know, and not even necessarily a problem. Like, yeah, maybe the scene kind of sucks where, like, you don't know how to role play as a spaceship or you need help or, like, we offer you suggestions or whatever. But, like, that's just, like, being in community with people playing games, I think.
Yeah, but I think a lot of the problems that we have at the table are being in community with people, and we create structures that, like, help us to support them through that. Even down to, like, turn taking.
Yeah, sure. I just don't see that feels like a taste thing for me, where that just, like, doesn't bother me more than having a single dullard. You know, I don't even, like, I don't love the, like, I'm doing a thing where I'm like picking on a fictional person, and I don't like doing it. But
I think the reality is that like I have felt like that person before in Games of Split Things, where like, you know, you're doing the French accent and you know all of the lore in this game and you are really good at coming up with fake Latin phrases or whatever. And I'm like, I'm trying, I'm coming along, but like, I'm not as interesting, or I'm not hitting this as hard, or I'm not contributing anything. And when you've got your own little character, there's this safe space in being like, but one, you can't compare me directly because no one else has touched this character. And two, I have the opportunity to like, put up the walls and be like, no, but I'm just playing this character the way that they would, you know, this is just the way that my veteran is. If I'm not as creative as you, that's okay too.
Yeah, this is totally a taste thing. Cause the other thing that I'm thinking about now is something that I say whenever I talk about like pre-generated characters. Did a whole episode on this with Aaron Lim last year, but like Last Train to Bremen, right, is a game about a band. They're on a train to hell. And they all hate each other because they're messy little animals. And the pre-gens in that game are like hound and mule and cat and cockerel, right? And a thing I really like in that game is like, I'll play as cockerel, but I'll see you play as cat. And I'll be like, oh, I love what you're doing with cat. That looks so much fun. Like, I want a chance to play Cat. I want a chance to do Hamlet, you know? Like, I'm watching Patrick Stewart do Hamlet, and I know I'm not going to be Patrick Stewart, but, like, won't it be fun to, like, get up on stage and, like, try to do Hamlet? Like, I should put together a reading. Like, I want my chance at that. And even if I'm ending up doing a bad impression of you playing Cat, it's still fun for me to, like, next time I play, be like, I remember what Sid did with Cat. Like, I'm going to pull that because, like, I want to do that. Like, that's fun. That I'm inspired by that. But that's totally a taste thing, right? Like,
I don't think it's totally a taste. I think taste is a big part of it. I don't think it's totally a taste thing. I think I want to go back to like something as simple as, because I mentioned to you earlier that I think we're in an era. I think we're in an era of what I would kind of call like anthropological design, which is that like we're no longer making rules to set play experiences. We're looking at what good play experiences are, and then we're making rules that demand them. And I think, you know, the great example of it is that we have these end of session XP things now that, you know, I think we saw them in Apocalypse World and Dungeon World, and then kind of in Blades in the Dark, they're really clear, where at the end of the session, if you showed off your vice and traumas to, you know, take an XP, and the intent behind those is that they're this mechanical structure to incentivize the two different types of the play structure, right? Showing us something about your character, and also at the end we get together and we talk about our favorite bits of the game that we played. And when I see the character non-monogamy section, or where I see it moving at the moment, is I see it moving unbounded by that desire to pull out specific play experiences. I see it moving towards the thing of like, you can all play different characters, or you can choose a character you really like and stick with them. Like, it's up to you. I don't see it being mechanically reinforced by system. Like, it doesn't feel like the character non-monogamy part is key element of like the fruitful void, where we have these large gravity bending rules that kind of draw play toward a determined experience or an intended experience. And I wonder, like, why not? And perhaps more importantly to me, what cool stuff can come out when someone does that?
Well, I would argue that Space Post is like trying to be a game about like doing low stakes chill kind hangout, you know, like that it's, I think the principles are very clear about that. We talked about this a bunch earlier, but I do think that the like character non-monogamy thing is in service of that. Like it feels to me like one of the things that the game wants to do is to make the table feel fair and like kind, and like I feel like part of how the game understands kindness and low stakes is at the like player level, not just the character and story level. And that if someone was locked into playing the space the space postman or the spaceship in this particular situation, that would create power dynamics, right? If someone was always the postman, then they would be in every scene. And if someone was always the spaceship, they would only be in every like fourth or fifth scene, you know, only the travel scenes probably. But like they also would have like a character who's around a lot more than like individual people receiving letters so maybe I'm playing six different people receiving letters and I'm around more, but like you have a character that's gaining more depth. And those are asymmetric in a way that is fine. That's great. I love that kind of game. You know, like I'm into that. But I think that the non-monogamous distribution of play is in support of that low stakesness at the table, because I think the non-monogamy, the rotating around those roles, means everyone gets more of a spotlight and means there it is less likely that like weird power dynamics will develop that lead to higher stakes. And I think that that's all operating on a really like small scale in Space Post. Like if you're showing up to play the game about like delivering the mail in space and like Animal Crossing kind of vibes, if you just kind of like sit around and hang out with your friends for 2 hours and don't say it much, like I think probably you're kind of expecting that, you know, like I don't think that that's a huge problem. I don't think it's likely that this game is going to lead to like big feuds at the table or anything. But I do think that like what I love in a game is when every single choice is considered in service of something. I think you were even kind of like saying the same thing in what you were describing right before me here, right? And I do think that the monogamy thing is maybe like a big choice. It feels like a big swing because it feels so non-traditional. But if you look at the game in the abstract, I think it is a small choice in service of that larger goal that like a bunch of other small choices are also pointing towards.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that Space Post was kind of the decision on which game we talk about is because I agree. Like in the same way I said, you can't just make fifth edition non-monogamous and it's a better game. You can't just make Space Post have character monogamy and it'd be the same game. It just wouldn't. It would play very different. It would be a different experience. And I think you would need to like change structures around that. I guess what I'm curious in, even when I look at games like, I know Warhammer Quest does it, right? Which is the board game Warhammer Fantasy dungeon exploration thing, where like they say, you know, just put all the characters between you and just take the one that you want to play today. And I think about the people that I have seen have negative responses to that, or who get attached to a thing, or who, you know, feel like, oh, I don't want to touch that because it's your character, or who feel like, oh, I really wanted to play my character and they're not available because of the structures in this game right now.
Yeah, yeah. I think much like many things in design, I mean, even as you were kind of saying before about like the 90s tradition of design, the default to that is what I want to challenge, you know, defaulting to that. That like what I want is to make a game that says like, you don't have to do that. Like in this game, that's not the right decision, you know, for a bunch of reasons we talked about, even if there also are like costs that come to band-aids and bullet holes when you're moving between characters. It's all trade-offs, you know, it's like what I'm trying to say is like everything is up for designability, you know, like you can make whatever choices you want. And like those choices have consequences. And like what I want is people who are considering everything, considering every choice, like making every choice intentionally. That's the word I'm looking for. Intentionality.
Yeah. And I think that the where I have settled on this and the bit that I really wanted to draw out of you here, and I'm glad that we did, is that this is an act of design rebellion, right? This is interesting because it is transgressive, because it breaks not only a norm, but it breaks an expectation in the players or a way that they're feeling, or, you know, that it invites some of those negative feelings about like, oh, I want, but it also invites a bunch of positive feelings, whatever. While in design, you know, every design choice is about where do you put the friction. I think the position that I have fallen on, I came into this not knowing where I was going to stand on character non-monogamy, not knowing really how I felt about it. And I think the position I've come to is one in defense of intentionality, even in the point of transgression, which is if you're going to make a game, you Sam, or you listener or editor or you or whatever, if you're going to make a game where you want me to switch characters with people, my two expectations for you is one, say it. Don't be like, oh, you can choose to, if you want, maybe trade characters. You're a coward and I don't like your design. My Strass and John in Band-A-Blades. Yeah, no.
I mean, that line of, that exact line of text is in Band-Aids and Bullet Holes right now. So I'll take it.
Like, rip it out. A, do what you want, but B, rip it out. Because, like, I think it's going to come down to the second part, the question, which is, what is your game intentionally designed for? And if your game is designed to be an avatar holding experience where that's the really interesting part and you get to develop these characters and wear them like a blanket with all the comfort and warmth and restriction that that implies, then do it. But if the game is better when we don't do it, make it not do it, you know, make it work that way. Add the tools and techniques that you need, the calling cards, and maybe add lenses and maybe like all these different approaches in order to make a game that plays the way that you want it to play. And I think that it is a really fun transgression to like hand over players and stuff. But like all transgressions, right? I don't want to be the 10-year-old like writing slurs on the wall of a public bathroom just because the transgressive act of, you know, using a word I'm not allowed to use. But what I do want to be is the person who writes a play that has some grandiose ascension to using a slur at the end of the second act or whatever. Like, you know, I want it to be part of the art. I want transgression to be intentional.
Well, I feel like I explained myself here. You've also played the game, even if it was a couple of years ago. Do you think I succeeded here in like being intentional with this or not?
No, I think it is really clear that you did succeed. And the best way I can sort of describe that is that I remember the scenes really clearly that we played, but I don't remember who we played. So I remember this scene in like a local street, like a rural sort of suburban street with all of us lined up, and there was the shootout and everyone had their like calling cards on display. It was this big dramatic moment. But like, I can't tell you who I played. Like, maybe it was Queenie, maybe it was Lockhart. Like that experience is about more than just the role that I played in it as a representation of a character. And I think it's beautiful for that. I think that Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is a great game. I think that it's a game that has captured what it means to care about the story rather than to care about the character. You know, you don't love the bastard because they're your character. You love them because they're the antagonistic force that makes the Bloodhound an interesting and dynamic character. Such a good game. Where can I back that?
There's a link in the show notes, or you can Google Band-Aids and Bullet Holes Kickstarter.
Heck yeah.
Thanks so much for being here, Sid. Really appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure. It was a real pleasure.
Oh, we got to do this again. Having you on is so much fun. Thanks again to Sid for being here. Go back Band-Aids and Bullet Holes on Kickstarter right now and then follow Sydney on Blue Sky at Sydney Icarus or check out the rest of their games at waxwings.com.au. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder, and you can find my games at sdunnewalt.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Spore Gree, our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pants by my boy, Travis Tesmer. This episode was edited by Emma Costa. Thanks, Em, and thanks to you for listening. See you next time. Goodbye!